You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you and good afternoon. Welcome to part two of our show from the Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club. An amazing story of the public coming together, not only through Catholic services, but through the city of Tucson and through volunteers who've helped their neighbors to the south, people that have gone 1,000 miles across Mexico, crossed the international border, and seek a better life in this country. We're not talking about illegal immigrants. We're talking about legal immigrants who are in a process of finding a better life here. People get confused, Steve Kosanchek, about who these people are. Describe them for us. Well, they're not illegals. No. Who have been busted and are on, on the lam from the government of the United States.
Yeah, as I was wandering through the place for the last couple hours, I've seen little kids running around. There was a mom who delivered a 5-pound preemie over here at Banner UMC. She actually had to have the Border Patrol agent in the delivery room with his gun on while she was delivering, as if that little kid was going to get up and run away.
Oh, boy.
We have all types of people showing up. About 90% of them are coming from Guatemala. The conditions that we hear about in Guatemala are the young mom who saw two of her infants starve to death, the young father who had his kids either dismembered or murdered, exploitation, all kinds of trauma, and roll into that the grief that comes when we lose loved ones. They travel across Mexico, as you just mentioned. They show up at the border, oftentimes dehydrated. It's 100 degrees outside right now, so they're dehydrated, they're tired, they're poorly clothed. They've got what's left of their family, coming here not to steal our jobs, but to come here and try and put their lives back together or create a life, period. Border Patrol processes them at the border. Those are the detention facilities that you see on TV. Once they have made contact with a next of kin or a foster somewhere else in this country, Border Patrol will then deliver them here to us. They're here for a couple of days, max. What we do is we have a volunteer who greets them outside, speaks Spanish, greets them and says, "We're not the government. We're here. You're welcome here. We're here to take care of you for as long as you need to be here." And you see this exhale of relief. It's the first time in weeks and weeks and weeks, if not years, that they've been treated like a human being. It's the first time that the kids have been allowed to be children and not under threat from drug gangs or from their own government or from their neighbors down there. We have about 400 volunteers who are serving here from all over the country. We have people flying in here from all over the country to serve as volunteers. And they're spending their summer down here just because they've heard the story and they want to be a part of it. What the volunteers do, we have people doing medical triage. We have people making meals. We have people doing laundry. We have people working on the phones, contacting next of kin, contacting their families back in Guatemala to let them know that their families got here safely, and getting them a bus ticket paid for by them, paid for by their next of kin or foster. The government's not subsidizing this. Ross Rolney is the property owner. He has been paying the utility bills ever since this thing opened up in January and has been really helping out a great deal.
Talk about how that worked out as far as a combination of you getting involved with him with you to make this happen.
Okay.
Because it was a great story of cooperation.
Yeah, it is. So Ross bought the place from the nuns for about $6 million. He's over a year ago at this point.
And so this is a great location, beautiful location.
It is going to be wonderful for however it gets repurposed. While he is going through the rezoning process, and that's going to take about a year, the numbers started to spike up a bit. And we decided, working with Teresa Cavendish, whom you had on earlier, that we needed to expand the operation beyond where we were working. It was out of some satellite churches. And so we brought Ross through. Teresa Cavendish brought Ross through and toured him through the facility. And through his generous spirit, he caught the bug. And said, we can let you use the building for a while, but that rezoning process is happening. It didn't stop when CCS, Catholic Community Services, moved in here. On our first walkthrough, the notion was we'll use one wing and we'll have 40 or 50 people and we'll keep them out of the sanctuary and the kitchen area and we'll make sure it's all kind of segmented and we'll put banner tape up. And it wasn't long before we were getting phone calls from Border Patrol and ICE saying expect up to 200 people per day for the indefinite future. And now it's the basement, this, the street level, the upper level are all being used for residential.
12,000 through here.
Of 12,000 since January.
Wow.
And to put that into context, in the previous 4 years, we had run about 6,000 through this city and through various churches. So the number has more than doubled. The time has constricted from 4 years to 6 months, and they're still coming. And as long as the conditions in Central America continue as they are, I don't see any reason for it to abate. When you hear the stories of the Mexican government interdicting them in Mexico and sending them back, that's not good news if you're one of the people who is being interdicted and sent home, because I just described to you the conditions that they're leaving. This country has always been a country that welcomes refugees. These people are here seeking asylum. They're seeking a better life. They're seeking a life.
And when you have the President of the United States calling them animals, it doesn't help the dialogue.
No, and thank God that when they show up here, they don't know that background. It's the fringe politics in this country that are driving that narrative. But when they show up in this building or when they show up in one of the other satellite churches that are operating, continue to operate in this city, they're greeted with open arms. They're you know, Border Patrol, when they get to the border, they take shoelaces, they take belts, they take rosaries, they take all the kinds of things that you know we just intuitively wouldn't think about. So they show up here with you know shuffling along with shoes with no shoelaces and pants with no belts, and when we have a room set aside here where they're allowed to pick up 2 days worth of clothing, you know, new shoes, new clothing, all donated by members of this community or people mailing stuff in from out of state. So the story of the Benedictine Monastery is known from San Francisco to New Brunswick, and people are, as I say, are both flying in and they're donating to help support these.
You take a look at these people that are here just for that brief length of time, whether it's 2 or 3 days, and it's hard to imagine what they've been through just to get here. You walk 1,000 miles across Mexico, you go through the terrible process of trying to get into this country through a system that's just completely broken.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. And then you finally get here and you realize you're not there yet. You still got a ways to go.
Yeah.
And people at least are helping you along the way. Right. There's a lot of love in this building, you know. I mean, it sounds a little corny to say that, but it's certainly true. Yeah. I mean, that's what's motivated this whole thing.
It's absolutely true. And so when I tour people through here, one of the things that I say to them is when you look in these kids' eyes, when you look in the parents' eyes, there's a story behind that face. And the story is what you just described. It's the arduous trip across Mexico. It's 100 degrees outside. It's the dehydration. It's the threats, if not the reality, of the exploitation and the murder that they're coming from. We had a woman in here last week whose bus traveling across Mexico, and she said that the bus was stopped. We don't know if it was from the Mexican military, from a drug cartel, or who it was. The driver was fatally shot, and all the women on the bus were raped. They show up here, and that's the trauma. That's the story behind the face that you're staring into. And you're right. When they show up here, there is a lot of love in this building, and these people are eternally grateful. We held an event in here several weeks ago, and the nature of the event, it was in the sanctuary, it was called Lend a Hand Senior Assistance, and it was 13 Midtown neighborhoods who had gathered together, and they were doing a 13 neighborhood yard sale here, the purpose of which was to help our seniors age in place and stay in their homes here in Tucson. It was a Friday-Saturday event, and during the Friday night, the refugee families that are staying here went into the sanctuary and draped blankets and things that they had been given over the pews so they could give back to this community. That's what they feel when they walk into this place, that level of concern and compassion.
Well, you've had the cooperation of the business community, the Tucson government, which would be the county, because the county is now working with you to move these people to the juvenile detention center. You got great cooperation from Chuck Huckleberry, who we just interviewed. And then you have a situation where you have community services, Catholic services, that have really been instrumental in making this whole thing happen. Then you have the city of Tucson, your office, and others. I've never seen that happen, coming together in such a concert of really on the same page. I mean, it's just amazing how that has happened. It's a great story. It really is. It's a Tucson story.
It is a Tucson story. It's not a Maricopa County story. It's
no.
a Tucson story. And what we are seeing here is the public sector, the private sector. Mostly what we're seeing, though, are residents of this community who are seeing this story, the bigger story, the national story on TV, and recognizing that right here in the heart of Tucson, there's an opportunity to be a part of that bigger story and to be a compassionate part of that bigger story. And that's why we have over 400 volunteers down here every single day doing this work.
That's a lot of people.
It is.
It really is. I mean, the whole process is everybody's screened, everybody's got identification, everybody kind of goes through a process, and they all have something to do, which is pretty amazing.
And that number is even an undercount, because the people who are supporting this in terms of donations, donating food and clothing and medical supplies and diapers and whatever you need to get on a bus and travel for 3 days with a couple of little kids, those are thousands of people in this community. I have Amazon delivering boxes to my office that have been mailed here from other parts of the country to bring over here. And what's in the boxes? Shampoo and diapers and stuff.
Wow.
You know, so it's thousands and thousands of people that are supporting the compassionate effort that's going into making this operation work.
And this isn't going to end this weekend. This is going to go on for a while. I mean, you've got 12,000 through now. You may have another 12,000 through the detention center later.
Well, sadly, that's true, unless and until we have a government that's prepared to work with the Central American governments and resolve the issues that are causing these people to have to leave. They're going to keep leaving. I would leave with my family. You would leave with your family under the same conditions. Anybody would leave with their family if their daughters were being raped and their sons were being murdered. That's why it's going to continue to happen. And as far as the county facility is concerned, Casa Olitas is a small operation here in Tucson under the umbrella of Catholic Community Services. I would love to see the new facility, the county facility, walk under the umbrella of Olitas Center. Let's just keep that spirit going in the new center. It's not a detention facility. We're taking doors off. We're laying carpet. We're taking the surveillance systems down. We're putting picnic tables with umbrellas outside so the kids can play and be out of the sun. The Olitas Center is going to be equally as compassionate and equally as welcoming as what this place has been.
You know, you've had critics that have said, what business is this of you and your responsibility as a city council person? Maybe you can explain that to them. I'll give you an opportunity to do that. Of what business is it of yours? What happens in this international trauma that's occurring in our town? And it had nothing to do with the city of Tucson,
yeah,
other than the fact they'd be walking the streets if they weren't here.
Well, so I've had some people complain that you have no right to use city dollars,
exactly,
taxpayer dollars. Well, first of all, there aren't any taxpayer dollars being spent on this yet. Ross Rolney has been footing a ton of the bill, and the volunteers in this community have been bringing in donations and supplies. All that set aside, I would support the city spending dollars on the county facility, on this facility, and the reason for that is that if we don't spend it on this humanitarian piece of it, we're going to be spending it on it. If we don't have an alternate facility, Border Patrol dropping these people off at the Greyhound bus depot, and then you've got street releases. Then you've got TPD involved. You've got Tucson paramedics involved. You've got the court system involved. You've got code enforcement involved. You're going to have taxpayer dollars spent at the front end or the back end. I would much rather see Tucson taxpayer citizens' dollars being spent on a loving and compassionate piece of this thing as opposed to a public safety and enforcement piece.
Well, Councilman, it's your legacy. I've told you that. It's a great legacy, too. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
We're going to talk with Ross Rolney next. He is the owner of this property. Who is this guy that would do so many great things under the auspices of an entrepreneur or developer? Who would do that?
Well, he's a compassionate guy, and you'll get a chance to hear from him in a few minutes.
We'll get a chance to hear from him next. Back to the John C. Scott Political Forum after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum. We are broadcasting live from the Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club, a story of migrants coming through our town, destined for other locations, and helped by neighbors from Tucson, Arizona, that have changed their lives, protected their lives, and offered them hope that they didn't have for ever so long. It is an amazing story. Well, Ross Rodney is with us, and Ross, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could be with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You're a Tucsonan. I didn't realize that. Yeah. I thought you were from someplace else.
No.
Where'd you go to junior high?
I went to junior high and high school at Sabino when they had 6 years.
They did. So that's right. I remember that.
I was on the Sabino six-year plan.
The six-year plan
that's
at Sabino.
Right.
Good
that's
grief.
Right.
You get out of Sabino, then what do you do?
Went to the university here, and my first career out of college took me to Chicago for a while.
You were on the Board of Trade?
I was bond and option trader at the Board of Trade.
Yep. That must have been exciting.
It was. It was short-lived. My timing wasn't great because I started just a few months before the crash of 87. So
nice going.
It didn't work out so well. But I did that for a couple few years and then ended up getting involved in a private business, a janitorial industry business, and started that and grew that for a while.
In Chicago
and ended up selling that and moving back to Tucson in 97.
And is that your first your real estate venture here in town?
In Tucson, just coming out here.
Made you say, I'm going to go back home and do this?
Well, I had two small children, and my family was out here, and I wanted to be closer to them, and I wanted my kids to grow up knowing their grandparents and uncles and cousins. And I was getting too entrenched in Chicago, so a decision had to be made for the long term. And that's when I decided to come back home. And as far as real estate, I didn't have a better idea. I got involved in a couple other businesses, but I wasn't a lawyer or a doctor, and I didn't know much about the optics. And real estate seemed like something worth trying.
But you were an early believer in downtown. Were you crazy at the time?
I was labeled
hallucinating.
I was labeled as too early, crazy at times.
There
but I've been labeled as crazy for many other things throughout my life. But I got involved in downtown. Started investing in downtown in '99.
Very early,
and that was early.
Yeah.
It was tough for a while, and I bled down there for a number of years.
Sure.
And every month, it was it took some trying and staying power to stick with it and convincing myself and the others around me that it was for all the right reasons. And finally, things started to happen, and here we are today.
Well, you had one successful venture, then another.
My focus has been on the 5th and Broadway intersection downtown. And I have a couple new projects that I hope will be coming out of the ground by the end of the year.
All right, let's talk about this facility. What attracted you to this facility? One, it's beautiful, obviously, but when did you say, I want to buy that?
So I was turned on to the monastery by an appraiser in town who was doing some work for the sisters and said to me, hey, Ross, I'm working on this project. It might be of interest to you. I don't know who else would try to pull something like this off that's local. It's probably going to end up going to somebody out of state. But if you'd like, I can make that introduction. And I said, sure, let's take a look. And it was just as simple as that.
What was your first impression as you walked through this place?
Well, it's you know, they say don't fall in love with your real estate. At least that's what they say in my business.
Yeah.
And that's impossible to do walking through these doors.
Yeah.
You immediately fall in love with this real estate, the history of this property, the sisters. I've grown close with some of them and am in constant contact with them, even back in Missouri. You walk through this and it just, the history, the feel, it just gets you real fast.
Well, it was built in 1940, mm-hmm. before World War II broke out, designed, and the architect was Roy Place, I believe it is, who did the county building downtown, and mm-hmm. as Chuck Huckleberry just pointed out, they are identical. You can see all the similarities that somebody had the same idea when they designed this facility. The one thing, and I've driven back and forth by here for years, I've been in this town for 50 years, I've always just seen that this is a place of serenity, just kind of an oasis in the middle of kind of a busy growing university area that kind of keeps creeping eastward and more so from Sam Hughes and beyond. But there's always a kind of a peaceful feeling driving right by Country Club, mm-hmm. no matter what. Mm-hmm. Even though there's no left turn lane, you had to stop. If somebody's going to turn left, you better stop. Sure. You know, but there was always something about this place. You mm-hmm. felt that too.
Oh, absolutely. And like we said earlier, I grew up in this community. I passed by this property
thousands of times.
It is beautiful. It will stay beautiful. It will always look like this when the sisters return years from now, they won't notice any change from the building itself. And that's always been important to me.
All right, what plans do you have for this after what has been a transition through this rather international story
sure.
of helping these people who have come so far with so far to go? What is your plan?
Well,
you had plan A and then plan B.
Plan A was... to get under contract and to try to understand the entitlements of the property as they exist today. And once we did that, the property was sold based on highest and best use. And highest and best use afforded me all kinds of opportunity that a lot of properties just don't. They don't have the zoning that this property had. But in working with the neighbors and in working with Councilman Kozacik and Ward 6, and a lot of negotiation and some horse trading, we came up with a better plan, something that the community could support, something that I think I can make work. And so the plan right now is to finish going through the entitlement process. If I am so fortunate to gain the needed approvals along the way, which should wrap up in September, then October, November, we'll start construction around the monastery. This will be designated a historic landmark, so the exterior of this building will always remain, and it will be preserved whether I'm around or not.
What kind of housing will you have here?
It'll be very high-end luxury rental housing, multifamily
really?
Housing. Yeah.
Multifamily.
Multifamily.
It won't be a dormitory.
Won't be a dormitory.
You had thought about that in the beginning?
It lays out well for a student property.
Yeah.
The location in Tucson, the size, I was able to assemble some additional acreage from the property next door out to Second Street. So because of the proximity to the university and the national investment opportunities in the student housing industry, it made sense, and it was an easier course to take. But for all the right reasons, I think we're headed in a very different direction.
So high-end multifamily mm-hmm. housing, mm-hmm. and how many acres are here? Eight?
There's about 7 acres.
Seven acres.
Yeah.
And you're going to preserve the orchard?
Well, no, that's not necessarily true. We're going to preserve the landscape immediately surrounding the monastery building.
Right.
Some of the orchard, I believe you're referring to the orange trees.
Yes, I am.
They've kind of had their day, and even if you ask the sisters, they've had to take down dozens and dozens of trees over the years just for failing health.
Right.
So most of those will come down.
Right.
We will transplant if we can. We will relocate if we can. The nice thing is all of the vegetation that is going to be removed or relocated is being grafted by Mission Gardens. So the legacy of what's out here will survive.
You didn't have to do any of this. You didn't have to do any of that. You could have built the dormitories and said, the heck with it. I've got the highest and best use, which is the highest and best use for my money. And you didn't have to do any of what you're doing.
Well,
why do you do this?
Well, I kind of feel like I do have to do it. I not everybody is going to agree with my approach. And my approach doesn't always come off the right how I would hope that it would right out of the gate. But the approach is, how do I come up with something that works for everybody and that I can survive? And there's other people involved. There's underwriters. I have a partner.
They want to make money.
That I have to answer to.
Yeah.
So how can we create an opportunity that we can all enjoy and be pleased with? Nobody's going to walk away getting everything that they wanted. But that's just not reality.
Right.
And I think we're about as close to that, a general consensus and full support, as a project like this can have.
But you've made some concessions along the way to Councilman Kasachak, to the public, to all kinds of people involved here. I don't know how difficult that was for you. Was it difficult?
Well, I remember being at some event at one of the resorts here in town, and it was about 10 o'clock at night, and it was just after my purchase went public. And I got a text message from Councilmember Kasachak saying, "Very sensitive property. We need to talk."
Yeah,
and that's kind of where it began.
Yeah.
You know, Steve made it very clear on what he would and what would not support, regardless of my existing entitlements. And he made it clear that that he thought it was in everyone's best interest that we try to find some compromise. And through a lot of work and effort, we were able to...
You wound up on the same page, didn't you?
Well,
as
far as...
The integrity of the property.
Yeah, well, I believe so. You know, my first foot forward was hiring Corky Poster, who is the lead preservationist architect
right.
in Tucson.
Right.
And I brought him on because I really wanted to be sensitive to the property, to the history of the property, to what it looks like today, to what it's going to look like in 20 years. And he's been incredible. His partner, Savannah McDonald, they both have been very careful and sensitive to the planning and working with the community to get us to where we are today.
Did you have any idea that this facility would be used by so many, 12,000 since the first of the year, to find a better way of life? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think you ever thought of those numbers, did you?
In short, absolutely
no.
not.
No.
I didn't even conceive of what was to take place.
Yeah. You thought, well, maybe a few families can stay here.
Well, and that's what it was. It really is a simple story. I was sitting in the Ward 6 office waiting my turn to go into a meeting. And I saw, I was eavesdropping on a conversation of some of the Ward 6 staff talking about the conditions that some of these people were experiencing and the conditions on the south side where they were currently being housed in a hotel and detention centers. And, I couldn't help but tune in to what they were discussing. Went in, had my meeting with Steve. Walked out, went back to my car, almost pulled away, went back inside, and I approached the group, and I approached Steve, and I said, is the monastery an option? I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know if it's even possible, but is that an opportunity that we should discuss? And then it just snowballed from there.
By the way, the monastery is so iconic, and it's just a marvelous facility. What do you think is possible for its multiple use? Is that going to be somewhat of a community resource for neighbors, for the town, for everybody, do you think?
So it's going to be a mixed-use property. There's going to be the residential component. There's going to be restaurant and all kinds of food service, coffee shops. There's going to be a new construction retail, which will have a coffee shop and a restaurant and some other neighborhood uses. And inside here, I envision, again, public space, mixed use. My wife and I traveled to Washington and looked at a product out there called The Line. It's a hotel where, it used to be a church that's a converted hotel, and you walk in from the street, it looks just like a church, just like it always has for decades and decades. But you walk in, and it's a wonderful public place for people to sit with their laptops and have coffee and have something to eat and enjoy each other's company and take a meeting. And that's what I hope to see happen here.
It's a wonderful nave. I don't know if that's what it's called here or not, but it's just a fabulous facility that you have here. The high ceiling, it's just beautiful.
I am very lucky to be the one with the opportunity to...
And that offers some opportunities and options for you, I would think.
Well, it does. It was interesting.
You can do theater there. You can do anything.
All kinds of things. You know,
the acoustics there are marvelous for music, for theater, for anything. I'm not telling you what to do with it. I'm just suggesting it's got some real possibilities.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree.
Yeah. The community's pretty much supported you, haven't they?
Well, it's been tough from the beginning, and I had to regroup on a lot of the things that I was considering in an effort to find common ground with different people that were very vocal in this process. Most of that was through the efforts of Ward 6. There have been countless meetings with the neighbors, countless meetings that have been orchestrated and through the ward office. And we have design committees that have neighbor representation for both Sam Hughes and Miramonte, and we've done a good job. In fact, one of the more vocal neighbors just during the last meeting said, "I think this is wonderful. I think
really?
This is about as
this
good.
Was a critic.
This was a critic, but who became a partner." And when I say partner, an activist in what happens with this property. And given all things considered and the different things that could have happened, she spoke very favorably of the plan moving forward.
Wow, that's a good feeling.
The sisters had a lot of different options of how to dispose the property and who to sell it to. And again, I feel very fortunate to have been selected.
Well, it's going to be an amazing effort on your part, and as well as the community, to adjust to it. I think that everybody's happy about this.
Well,
I know I'm thrilled about it.
Well, thank
and,
you.
And, you know, I don't think people feel that way about a lot of projects in town. They may eventually come to like them, but in the beginning, there are always kind of a lot of doubters along the way. But a lot of people believe in what you're doing, and they thank you for the sacrifice you're making to really be a treasure for everyone. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
By the way, when you see the people walk through here, you would have never known these people. Never. You would have never seen their eyes. You would have never seen their faces. You would have never hugged them. You would never have ever known them.
No. And when you walk through these halls, the first thing that comes to mind, both my wife Lisa and myself, is what else should we be doing? What else could we be doing? And that's the thought that I leave with. And I take home.
Well, you got to take home with you the tremendous contribution you've made to their lives and the lives of so many, and to this community.
Well, thank you.
It's good to feel good about what you do, isn't it?
Thank you. Thank you.
Ross, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for your kind words.
You bet. Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club, the location of the John C. Scott Show. Ross Rodney was with us. He is the owner of this property, an amazing individual who is doing something that is so remarkable. I'm wondering why it has not been done so many times before. Valerie James will be with us, an art project involved in this amazing, amazing exercise of helping people. That's after these messages. Welcome to the John C. Scott Political Forum. Benedictine Monastery, the 800 North Country Club, is the location of our show. We're telling you the story of what is going to happen to this marvelous facility and what use it is to put to today, as 12,000 people have come through here and have been helped along the way as they move from Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, to a place that is better for them. These are not illegal immigrants. These are people that are going through the process of finding a legal means to enter the United States and stop here along the way with the help of so many. Hope and Healing is the Art of Asylum at the Monastery, July 12th through August 31st. And Valerie James is with us. She's put this all together. Hi, Valerie. How are you?
Hi.
All right, tell me how you decided to do this, Hope and Healing in art.
Well, actually, it came together pretty naturally, pretty organically, as the art began to grow and kind of fill the walls of the monastery.
And these are kids and moms and dads that are all drawing things, right? This
yes.
is the original art.
Yes, children and adults. And
this had to be marvelous. You have what wonderful insight.
It's incredible. I mean, we work with such creative, phenomenal, heart-filled people here.
Well, what sticks out in your mind is a piece of artwork that you saw from one of these people that you just can't forget?
Oh, my. Oh, there's been so many. There was one piece, and I think some people have seen it. It's been shown around because it's just so clear. It really speaks to the issue of freedom, liberty. And it's a bird that's flying out of a cage. Mm-hmm. You may have heard about it. It's just this beautiful spare drawing, and the bird is flying towards the sun. The door of the cage is wide open, and this bird is free. And wow. Around these three elements, the cage, the bird, and the sun, is negative space. It's just white. So it's very powerful. It's very graphic.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, you found this and other pieces of art, and you decided to do something with them.
Yes, we've had a longstanding directive that's sort of a deceptively simple prompt, which is to draw what you love. We have found that this is really the way to go with our guests, really meeting them where they're at. And over time, we've just learned to really listen and observe and to be aware of what they need. If you're asking someone to draw what you love, you're asking them to enter into a space that's really healing, you know, a natural sort of respite where you're drawing what you love. And so what we have found is, above and beyond anything else, being able to have space and time to draw and paint in this way gives respite for these folks who have been through God knows what. I mean, we can't even imagine what they've been through. And so for us here, you know, it's our job to make a safe space for them. And this is a sanctuary, a santuario, this monastery. And the art really just helps to sort of enter into that place inside.
Some of this artwork will be on display for people to see. How, in what form will that take place?
Well, we have drawing and painting. We even have some three-dimensional work, you know, silly puppets and Play-Doh and all the things that kids adore.
Sure.
We have lots of original embroidery that the women here have made, and we help them. We host groups in which we give them the materials that they need, and then they create their own work from scratch. They design their own work. We give them a panuela, a handkerchief, and universal design images of flowers and butterflies. And these women have mad skills. I mean, they could teach us so much because it's part of their culture and part of the family, this kind of contemplative, beautiful work. And so the women take the embroidery with them on the road, so they have projects they're actually able sometimes to finish on the bus, so that the mothers actually get a break, because they never get a break.
They don't seem to. I don't think mothers ever do. July 12th through August 31st on display at Ward 6 Council?
Yes, and we hope everyone will come. It's pretty incredible.
3202 East 1st.
Yes, and this is a really rare opportunity to witness what the experience of migration looks through a child's eyes. These are their visual testimonies. So this work is so honest and so authentic. It's inarguable. Seeing this work will blow your mind.
Wow.
And there's so much, I mean, you can't even imagine how much hope you see, you know, all these bright colors and beauty. So in the midst of everything, hope prevails, which is phenomenal. It really shows us a lot about faith.
You know, we've seen these young people that may be involved in this artwork see death. People have died along the way. They've seen horrible attacks on perhaps mothers and family. They've seen brutality of authorities who've tried to manage their trek across Mexico and then manage their entrance into the United States. It's been one of these situations in which there's been authorities that have played a tremendous role in what they've experienced. How does that come out? Because we've seen artwork of cages and brutality that was shocking to me, just absolutely shocking.
Yes.
And it was it was more graphic than any photograph I've ever seen.
I agree. I was really blown away by the images we've seen just recently. And you're absolutely right. They're so much more powerful than anything we can imagine. Because, again, this comes straight from a child's honest heart.
Yeah.
And so you will see images like this. But you will also, by contrast, see the hope. You know, kids are so tremendously resilient as it is. And these kids are amazing, absolutely amazing. Now, feelings still come up and through. I mean, people, one of the things about having an arts and activities classroom is that people have a safe place to have respite and to have their feelings. And so people will spontaneously cry. And when that happens, you know, our people here, you know, all you need to do is be human and put your arm around someone and just, you know, really be present for them and their feelings. And then they're able to go right back into the work and engage in the art. So it's very, very therapeutic in a very natural way.
You know, some of these children have said, we've been told, that your face and the faces of so many of these volunteers were the first friendly face they'd seen in months.
Yes.
Or perhaps years. I mean, just somebody taking the interest to say, how are you? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do you feel? Mm-hmm. And what can I do for you? I mean, it was so amazing. The power of love is just so great.
And
matched against the power of hate, which we've witnessed not only in the cartels and the experiences in their home countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, but even through Mexico, and now into the United States of brutality, and then to a friendly place of sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that again, sanctuary.
That's right.
That is a place of love and comfort and safety.
And, you know, we as volunteers, especially with the children, we are just using child-centered practices. This is what we do with our own children here, or we should be doing. And so, you know, we're basically just being moms and grandmas and, you know, just being loving presences. And I got to tell you, it's some of the most gratifying work I've ever done as a volunteer.
Really?
Anywhere. And, you know, it is my serious honor and pleasure to be that face. I mean, I really strive to be the best that I can be for these kids. I want them to be able to remember their time in Tucson in a way that, you know, gives them pleasure.
Well, it's the Art of Asylum at the monastery, July 12th, that's coming right up, through August 31st, the Ward 6 Council Office at 3202 East 1st Street, mm-hmm. Monday through Friday, 9 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon. There's an opening reception Friday, July 12th, that's coming right up Friday, 6 to 8 o'clock
mm-hmm.
in the evening. You'll be there, and
yes.
The artwork will be there. I don't think you're selling it. It's just on display, isn't it?
It's on display. We will be. We do have some posters and some postcards. So there are things that the public can buy, but the original work, we're photo archiving, and we're going to make sure that it stays safe and secure.
By the way, what instruction was there available when these children started drawing? Was there any at all? I mean, any guidance, or you just said, here?
Most of the time, when I volunteered last year back at Casalitas when we were in a small house, you know, all the artwork that was done was all self-directed. We just basically hosted and gave kids and adults the materials that they needed. Here, it's very much the same way. We do have this one prompt that we use a lot, as I mentioned, draw what you love. But you will find work in all the different rooms of the monastery that children and adults do on their own time, you know, that is everywhere. And it's all self-directed. These are people so creative that make their own entertainment in Central America. You know, they don't have these kinds of entertainment portals that we do. And so for these kids to even have access to simple watercolor paints, to feel and to use simple tracing paper, I mean, things like this that we take for granted, for them, it's like gold.
Wow.
I mean, they are just so excited to have this material. And in the activities classroom, we conduct it as a class to give the kids a taste of what it will be to go into a regular classroom. And so, you know, we have the kids wear name labels. We teach the kids how to raise their hands and ask questions. So the kids really, it's phenomenal to see the kids and the parents have this palpable like a sense of relief. I mean, completely relaxed when they open the door. It's the classroom. And so many people on their own, many of the parents have drawn images of the monastery, which you'll see in this art show. And oftentimes, right in the center of the monastery will be a space that will say Escuela. It's the school. Because education is so important for these people, you know, and for them, the idea that there's actually, you know, a place where they can begin to learn, for instance, emergency English, English for the road. This is something else that we provide our activities department. You know, these are the kinds of things that they are coming here for. You know, the idea that their kid could actually have it, be able to get in school and to be able to graduate is just... It's the American dream.
You know, and some, I don't know what the breakdown of the demographic is, but almost half of those people coming through here are children.
Yes.
I mean, you're talking about 12,000 since the first of the year, 12,000. Mm-hmm. So you must have seen 5,000-6,000 students or, you know, had at least some encounter with many of those 6,000. That's a lot of kids.
We've had really large classes.
Yeah.
Extremely large, and oftentimes we'll need 4 or 5 facilitators, and we can always use volunteers.
Right.
You know, so, and the best volunteers, you know, we have so many incredible volunteers here in Tucson, so many educated folks and people that, you know, have backgrounds in teaching. And but I'll tell you, the best volunteers are, in my mind, are grandmothers and mothers and fathers, too, who think on their feet, who respond with love, who are there to give the kids what they need, you know, literally are just decent human beings. So, hey, you know, if you fit that bill, just come on over, because we can really use you.
The Art of Asylum at the Monastery, July 12th through August 31st, Ward 6 office at 3203 East 1st Street, Monday through Friday, 9 in the morning till 4:30, and an opening reception July 12th, 6 to 8 o'clock. Valerie, thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate it. I want to thank Dr. Richard Carmona, former Surgeon General of the United States, and Teresa Cavendish, who is with us from the Catholic Community Services. Chuck Huckleberry, Chief Administrator of Pima County. Ward 6 Councilperson Steve Kasacek. And Ross Rolnick, who owns this property, the monastery. And Valerie James, our artist. Hope and Healing, the Art of Asylum in the Monastery. Thanks for listening to our special show, the John C. Scott Broadcast from the Benediction Monastery, 800 North Country Club. Have a great evening, everyone.